Now, a look at another controversial use of military force. This week, two events framed the argument over the use of drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda confirmed that one of its founding members, a man named Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, was killed by a drone attack inside Pakistan. American officials called his death a major setback for Al-Qaeda.
So that's one event, and here's the other, the U.S. military investigation into the death of 23 Afghan civilians. The investigation found that a team operating a surveillance drone made a mistake. It identified a convoy of vehicles as full of insurgents, when instead there were women and children on board. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston looks at whether drones hurt the U.S. war effort more than they help.
At a practical level, the most basic question for U.S. policymakers is whether drone attacks work. The technology is seductive. Drones can watch a target without being detected and then strike without warning. The CIA and the U.S. military both use drones.
On the one hand, they're powerfully effective at eradicating our enemies.
That's Sam Raskoff. He's an NYU law professor and a former NYPD intelligence chief. The problem, he notes, is that the killings can alienate the people of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
On the other hand, they might simultaneously be powerful tools at motivating our enemies. So from a counterterrorism standpoint, they're very effective. From a counterinsurgency standpoint, they raise lots of questions.
And the U.S. is trying to do both.
And I think the drone points up in a very sharp-edged sort of way the conflict, the tension between those two strategic objectives.
That's the argument counterinsurgency experts have been making for months. They say the drone attacks increase the number of Pakistanis who support extremism, and that for every enemy killed, more are created. Again, Sam Raskoff.
Well, we hear reports, including from homegrown terrorists, that drone attacks against villages in Afghanistan and Pakistan are part of what's motivating them to engage in violence.
So that's the practical question. There's another debate over whether the drone attacks are legal and moral. These attacks are often called targeted killings of suspected terrorists, for example. The official U.S. position is that the strikes are permitted. The U.S. is at war with Al-Qaeda and has a right to defend itself. A new U.N. report questioned that legal logic. Others have raised questions, too. Here's Columbia law professor and former Pentagon official Matthew Waxman.
The next step in that argument, and where it becomes most controversial, is that not only are we in a war with Al-Qaeda, but this is a war that extends geographically across territorial bounds.
In other words, if the drone strikes are permitted in Pakistan, why not anywhere else? The U.S. drones have already struck in Yemen. Where are the boundaries? Another legal challenge? The UN report says that drones fired by the CIA are less acceptable than drones fired by the military because it says the CIA is less accountable. Consider this latest CIA drone attack that killed Al-Qaeda's number three man. He's thought to have been the mastermind of an attack that killed CIA agents in Khost, Afghanistan last year. The concern is that the CIA drone attack was motivated by revenge rather than the legitimate right to self-defense. So those are the legal concerns. There's one more worry. What to expect of the person who pulls the trigger? It makes a difference whether you're a drone operator thousands of miles away or a Marine on the ground.
The Marine who is in Afghanistan does not have time. As one Marine said in an email message to one of my research assistants, when in doubt, empty the magazine.
John Radson is a law professor at William Mitchell College and a former assistant general counsel at the CIA. He says that unlike the Marine, a drone pilot's life isn't in danger. He can have a drone follow a target for hours, gathering intelligence, making sure the right person is in the crosshairs.
Based on the different facts, there's going to be a different application of the laws of war. We hold the drone operator to a higher standard.
Critics want the American drone program held to a higher standard, too. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The United States has a new military command, this one focused on cyber war. 2 weeks ago, Congress affirmed Army General Keith Alexander as head of U.S. Cyber Command. Today, in his first public comment since his confirmation, General Alexander laid out some of the challenges he faces, among them deciding when and how to wage cyber war. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The U.S. military is organized around a series of commands. Central Command is in charge of all warfighting in the Middle East. It's mostly on land. Pacific Command focuses on Asia. That's largely about sea power. Special Forces Command has the expertise on clandestine operations. But war in cyberspace would be like nothing that has come before it. What does territory mean? What is legal? What is ethical? General Alexander says he's concerned about the lack of cyber warfighting guidelines. One example he cited, what if a country launches a cyber attack against the United States or someone else from computers based in a third country?
It's not unlike warfare where you have armed conflict going in one state and somebody attacks from a neutral state in. There are laws of land warfare that deal with that. We now have to look at that in light of cyberspace.
Conventional warfighting is governed by internationally agreed laws of war, and U.S. commanders in the field are given so-called rules of engagement, specifying what they can do in particular situations, who can be attacked, under what circumstances, with what level of force. But cyber commanders have not been told how exactly they should respond to an attack on U.S. computer networks.
What we have to establish are clear rules of engagement that say what we can stop.
Here's an example of something that's not clear. The United States years ago made clear it might strike preemptively against a terrorist group or enemy state if it's necessary to stop an attack against the United States. But could General Alexander order a preemptive cyber attack to stop someone from penetrating our computer defenses?
He needs clear guidance.
Jeffrey Smith is a former CIA general counsel.
From the president, secretary of state, director of national intelligence, attorney general, and so on, as to how cyber assets may be employed, what may he, as the commander of Cyber Command, do?
General Alexander, for example, might be inclined to order an attack against a computer network in another country if there's evidence those computers are attacking the United States. But just as commanders need to worry about civilian casualties from an airstrike, General Alexander would also need to worry about collateral damage to innocent computer users. An important issue here is whether U.S. Cyber Command, which is under the National Security Agency, gets the authority to identify computer users at home and abroad who have malicious intent. That raises privacy issues. General Alexander says he'll depend on good oversight so he can demonstrate that his cyber warfighters are abiding by U.S. law.
I think the real key to the issue, how do we build the confidence that we're doing it right with the American people, with Congress and everyone else? That's going to be the hard part.
The overseers here, General Alexander said, will be the U.S. courts and the U.S. Congress. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. BP has had some success vacuuming up oil from its ruptured well at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, but President Obama says it's way too early to be optimistic. Mr. Obama returned to the Gulf Coast yesterday for the third time since a deepwater drilling rig exploded more than 6 weeks ago. He warned BP not to, quote, nickel and dime the people who've been hurt by the oil spill. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The table in front of President Obama was piled high with boiled shrimp and bright red crawfish. But this was no picnic. Mr. Obama had returned to Grand Isle, Louisiana, to meet with fishermen and coastal business owners whose livelihoods are threatened by the BP spill. Encroaching oil has closed the oyster beds that Floyd Lassane maintains. Lassane doesn't know where his next catch is going to come from.
I'm a fourth generation, and I got a son that's a fifth generation. Somebody at least has been in the family for 100 years.
David Cammerdale is the mayor of Grand Isle. His brother owns the bait shop where this meeting was held. The mayor warned that unless cleanup crews are able to keep the oil from seeping deeper into the area's estuaries, the region's $2 billion fishery could be in jeopardy.
The biggest shrimp dock in America is right here in Grand Isle, and he's completely shut down. Close to 100 boats just tied up. You got the Vietnamese families, you got the true Cajun people here, and they're just sitting on the deck of the boat.
The president listened as Camerdale outlined a plan to sink barges off the coast, anchoring rock dikes to catch the approaching oil before it can reach the sensitive wetlands. Mr. Obama was accompanied by Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, who's in charge of the federal response. He also brought along his political advisor, David Axelrod, in a sign that his own fortunes are also on the line. A crowd of well-wishers cheered when the president's motorcade arrived in town, but John Young, who chairs the Jefferson Parish Council, says this area needs more than just a presidential pep talk.
I was out yesterday on East Grand Terre Island, and, you know, we have dead pelicans, birds soaked with oil, and they still haven't plugged the hole, so we're counting days now, and we're on 46. I'm happy that he's here. I respect him. I respect the office, but we need some action, not just words.
Mr. Obama didn't mince words, saying the oil spill will be bad no matter what the government does. But he said a coordinated response could help.
Yeah, there's oil washing in, but people can help each other. And the company that's responsible can make sure that it's responding quickly and effectively.
Some residents complain BP has been anything but quick in processing claims after writing an initial round of checks. Mr. Obama warned the company it has legal and moral obligations in the region, especially since he said it's spending tens of millions of dollars on TV ads to repair its image and might pay more than $10 billion this year in dividends to its shareholders. Some financial analysts say BP is likely to cut its dividend over the spill, but the company itself has been noncommittal. Shrimp fisherman Terry Vegas told the president he's not bitter at the oil companies, just those that cut corners and caused all this havoc.
We thrive on the oil company down here, and we enjoy the business. We support them.
Well, I think the point with the oil companies is they've got to support you the same way you support them.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has warned the president's six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling will cost more jobs that his state can ill afford to lose now. Mr. Obama said yesterday he's unwilling to resume drilling in deepwater before a safety review is completed, but he has urged his safety investigators to work as quickly as possible.
We're still going to need oil production, but we've got to make sure that we do it in the right way.
The oil spill continues to sap attention from other issues on the president's agenda, and this week it forced him to postpone an upcoming trip to Australia and Indonesia. Before driving out of Grand Isle, past oil containment booms yesterday, Mr. Obama told residents he's thinking about them even when he's not in town. He said he hopes to come back to Grand Isle when the oil's been cleaned up for another seafood feast. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Today, AT&T is making available a new pricing plan for iPhone and iPad users. It's a shift in the way that phone companies have previously charged people for the downloaded data from their mobile devices, and it could influence other companies as well. To find out more, we've reached out to Matt Buchanan. He's with the technology blog Gizmodo.com. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not sure that most of us, even those of us who may have a mobile phone with data, understand exactly how we're being charged for it. What is it that AT&T has been doing with iPhone users and iPad users?
So what they've been doing, and what most carriers have been doing in the U.S. anyway, is you'll pay around $30 a month for an unlimited amount of data. You can download as much as you want. You can upload as much data as you want.
If I'm totally obsessed and on this 12 hours a day, it's still just $30 a month.
Yep, I've heard of people going crazy downloading 20 gigabytes of data over their phone, which is a lot of data in a month. So, and that's part of the reason they're moving to these new pricing plans, is because their network is kind of strained by all these phones. So what they're trying to do, and what AT&T says, is that 98% of users use less than 2 gigabytes of data a month. Mm-hmm. So what they're aiming at is this top 2% of users who use a disproportionate amount of data. The top 10% of users use around 50% of all bandwidth. Mm-hmm. On the network, and so that's what they're really targeting. Most people, though, probably use under a couple of hundred megabytes a month. For those people, the argument is that they'll be saving $5 a month on the new data.
Because it goes down to $25 from $30, is that right?
Right. There's two new options coming up. Mm-hmm. There is a 200 megabyte plan for $15 a month, and then there is a 2 gigabyte plan for $25 a month.
Okay.
If you go over, you can get another gigabyte of data for another $10, which is actually a fairly reasonable overage fee.
What happens if I'm one of these super, super users who is downloading music videos all the time and using tons of things and reading books on my iPad and doing a million other things at once? Maybe, using the NPR app, any kind of thing like that.
You'll be paying more for that data. The point is that you're going to be paying for all of the data you use. It's not an all-you-can-eat buffet anymore.
And so what's wrong with that?
Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that, actually, because network capacity is a finite resource. And so when you have a small number of users responsible for people maybe dropping calls in certain areas and this sort of thing, you understand why there's an incentive to have people use less of the network and less bandwidth when you have these phones that can do so much. But there are a couple of things going on here. If you look at the way that the pricing structure is laid out under the new plan, you're actually paying more per megabyte of data. Like if you break out how much you're paying for each byte of data, people getting the $15 a month plan are paying a lot more per byte than people on the 2 gigabyte plan and people obviously under the unlimited plan.
The bottom line is rather than a flat fee, you're getting charged a range of fees by AT&T. Other companies could plausibly follow this. And I suppose that your reporting follows on the suspicion that most of us would have. When a company goes to the trouble of messing with its price structure like this, one way or another, they're going to get more money out of us. That's why they do it, right?
Yes. A lot of people will save money initially. But the issue for me is in 6 months, 2 gigabytes of data, which for now is a lot of data for most people, may not seem to be that much data, especially when you have the new iPhone coming out that can stream Pandora or NPR in the background. You'll be able to stream.
Use it as a full-service radio, basically, a music
right.
service.
The amount of data that seems like a lot today may not seem like so much tomorrow.
So basically, AT&T is setting us all up to profit later from our crack addiction.
Yes. Well, and I mean, it was, you know, this model in some ways was sort of inevitable. The all-you-can-eat buffet can only last so long because, you know, when you're talking about millions of phones downloading gigabytes of data a month, that's a huge infrastructure problem. And AT&T's just been hit the hardest by it because they've had the phone that's been most attractive for this kind of thing. You know, right now, other carriers so far are sticking with the all-you-can-eat plan. But typically in the phone industry, at least in the U.S., when one carrier makes a big move, the others follow in due time. So AT&T is really the first to move from this all-you-can-eat to paying for every pound that you eat.
Matt Buchanan writes for Gizmodo.com. Matt, thanks very much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. The biggest news in the tech world today comes from Steve Jobs at Apple.
Today, we're introducing iPhone 4, the fourth generation iPhone. Now, this is really hot.
A lot of people got a glimpse of this new phone in April when a prototype was found in a bar and sold to Gizmodo, the tech blog. NPR's Laura Seidel was in San Francisco for today's unveiling of the real thing. And Laura, how does it compare with those photos we saw some time back?
Well, it's the same phone. And Jobs actually got a good laugh when he introduced it and he said, I don't know if you've ever seen this before.
Uh-huh.
but it pretty much looks like what we saw, and it's thinner than the current iPhone. And according to Mr. Jobs, it is the thinnest phone on the market. It's made of glass and stainless steel. It's got a camera on the front and the back, as was advertised. As has been rumored, it has video chat, and they're calling that FaceTime. For now, you can use video chat only on Wi-Fi, but it was pretty cool, I have to say, to see somebody be up there on a phone. He called up Jonathan Ives, who is one of the designers of it, and they spoke using video. So that was pretty amazing. It has an HD video camera. And so it's possible even to edit HD on this. The camera has a flash, and the flash can be kept on long enough while you're shooting videos. It has a lot of great features.
And Laura, you have used the new iPhone. What struck you most about it when you tried it out?
The resolution. It really, you know, it's so much clearer than the old phone and so much clearer than pretty much any other phone on the market. So you can really read easily on it. It had iBooks, so you can now read your books on it. You can read it on that, and you can read it on the iPad and the iPod Touch. It has multitasking. This is a big thing that people have been, you know, wanting for some time, is to have multitasking. And it has that. And I would say just being able to use, I used the video camera, and it's a really nice camera. You can edit it and put together little films right on your phone.
Okay, Laura, not just a new phone. There's also a revised data plan from AT&T. Tell us about that.
That's right. So you can't just get all you can eat anymore. You have to get $15 or $25 worth of limited data. As this goes along, that could become a bigger problem with people because, remember, now you have HD video, right? That's going to be a lot more data to send. And so I do wonder down the line, eventually, if people are going to have to start paying more if they're really using that HD video camera and using that high resolution.
Okay, and here's Laura Seidel in San Francisco. Laura, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Apple debuted its newest version of the iPhone yesterday. It will support a slick new kind of advertising called iAds. That should give Apple and its applications, or app developers, a nice chunk of change. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
According to Apple CEO Steve Jobs, it will be possible to put iAds into an app in one afternoon. Apple will sell and design the ads.
What we're trying to do with iAds is we're trying to combine the emotion of video with the interactivity of the web.
Jobs showed off a yet-to-be-released car ad.
The 100% electric Nissan Leaf.
The ad for the Nissan took advantage of the gyroscope in the new iPhone 4, so Jobs tilted the phone and it changed the color of the car. The creative minds in advertising are likely to find new ways to use what's available in iAds, says Forrester research analyst Julie Ask.
When you talk about the ability to put a gyroscope or proximity sensing, location, accelerometers, and mix that into an ad, we could see some very creative results.
Ask says advertisers could take advantage of location services to push customers into a nearby store. Apple will take 40% of the revenue generated by the ads. That's a pretty high percentage, say some analysts. But for app makers who've been giving it away for free, this might sound like a good deal. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.